Thank you, Angarad. We can have some question to the debate now. Paola?
Yes, I can. Thank you very much for your presentation. As I already said, I'm Brazilian, so next games will be in Rio. And I'm already very worried about what happened there in the city itself. And I think there's a very important political and social question here about how the idea of atmosphere is being used also to hide and to show other things than the resistance and the evictions and all the privatizations and etc. caused by the games in the city and the urban hall. My question is how you, if you already studied the relationship between this atmosphere making and the real urban transformations in London.
No, I haven't. And to be honest, it was quite accidental that I started thinking about the Olympics at all, and I'm still surprising myself that I'm still working on it, because I thought it would be just a very temporary thing and then I'd move on. But it's very difficult because it opens up so many different avenues that are all interesting. I mean, it just took place for me at the end of last summer, just as I'd completed a book project on the politics of nationalism. And I just watched this event for 2 weeks with everyone talking about the atmosphere and started to think, oh my goodness, I haven't said anything about atmospheres or feelings or emotions of nationality in the book. And this now seems totally central to the operation of nationalism and how it works. So, I mean, that can take us in so many different directions. I feel that, you know, that there's something to be understood about the architecture of stadiums, and I'd love to know more from people who study the work that goes into thinking about how we actually make people feel part of a crowd. And then there's more work I need to do also about thinking about the difference between a collectivity, a crowd, a mob, a group, a nation, you know, all these different modes of understanding being together. And how do you move from one to the other? So when does a nice national event, happy nationalist event, become an ugly nationalist event? How do the people turn into a crowd or turn into a mob? How does that take place? And how can we understand those shifts, I suppose? And for me, I feel atmosphere is offering me a way into those sorts of questions.
I'm just trying to think through that, and thank you, it's a really interesting presentation. I wonder if nationalism is quite right as a lens, just that actually a part of what was extraordinary about the event was more its transnational character. And that speaks perhaps less to the UK in the wider way than perhaps London very specifically as an intensification of a real kind of social change that's going on in Britain, where a lot of people who are resident in London perhaps claim a certain kind of identity relative to London and not necessarily claiming that relative to the rest of the UK. I live just north of the site, and I think that some of those kind of areas are really characterised by a kind of population that's not there, doesn't necessarily see itself as being fixed there, but is mobile, has a sense of itself as having moved there and been moving through it at some point, but that somehow the event sort of gathered or intensified momentarily people's feelings of collectivity or the common. I think you use that word more common than I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I think you're right, and that question has come to me in different forms, actually. One form was, well, this isn't about nationalism at all, it's about sport, it's about a mass event, and that's why I had the section in about, you know, the history of different Olympic Games' relationships with nationalism, and that extends to the kind of Cold War, war over medals and so on. But I think you're right as well, that nationalism does not necessarily, as a lens, allow me to get at the get the different modes of expressing being in common or something in a lighter way rather than with this sort of clunky fist that nationalism suggests. So that's something I'm working on, and thank you. And part of what I want to sort of unpack, I suppose, is both on the one hand the way in which the national and the international and the urban London city world operated together as three closed but overlapping communities, but of course that there are different nationals, different internationals and different urban lives going on in London as well, which all contradict those models of community offered in the standard narrative. So yes, something I've got to think through. Thank you.
Well, I was just going to kind of do a think on from that, because it's something I've been thinking, writing about that quite a lot. And I think what makes it very difficult is, or to what you're doing very difficult, is that what we're dealing with precisely is the ability of the manufacture of consent, the manufacture of meaning, to elide and to eclipse differences, so that we know you're kind of saying you're talking about nationalism, but not really talking about nationalism, all about sport. And what we fall back on often is the notion of what we're being told we're dealing with, which is community or communality or common. And you know, what I was wondering was, you began kind of asserting that 72%, or you know, citing a poll that said how many Londoners, how many people were satisfied or felt they were valued for money. And it seems that what we have to somehow interrupt is the persistence of that message. You're dealing with a series of messages, and we all make the game. You know, that's very, very powerful and very present. And it was reinforced by all sorts of other advertising groups, which were always talking about taking you to the heart of, taking the idea of being transported and being, you know, carried together. And the ability of that, through using social media, through using the, I'd say less it's actually fragmenting and kind of consolidation of a series of presentnesses of social media, like the notion of immediacy or liveness or upload now, which sort of always is going to slightly, is going to try and catch you one step behind. It's going to sort of elude your ability to actually critique it, because it works by a process of absolute sort of modulation or sort of ability to represent itself as something other than representation of a representation. And I think, I get thinking of outer zone, you haven't mentioned, but that notion of, you know, interpolation or of sort of somehow, but now to the second or third order, so that people who are, have no ways in kind of national investment or investment in this thing called, you know, British citizen, are somehow respond to, you know, somehow interpolated into that kind of, you know, volunteer, you are, you know, national service, you are, and the constant reinforcement of that notion of a we, which will always try to embrace you, no matter how Ian Sinclair, like, you try to kind of pull you into grasp.
Yeah.
And going, I was coming and going into London as well, in the process of the games going on, and kept sort of wondering the way in which I was somehow swept up, caught up, you know, embracing something which was forever trying to sort of be like my possibility of resisting it, which is maybe again what, you know, atmosphere and what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was rather an announcement rather than a question. But
that's really useful, thank you. I mean, in my own work, I feel in the past, in my approaches to nationalism, I've positioned myself as a critic, but sort of on the outside of the workings of nationalism, so, you know, and this is something I want to kind of get away from. So when you were describing yourself getting caught up in it, I think, you know, I'd rather with this try and unpack, well, yes, how is it that we're all swept up in this thing, and but that there may be moments in that machine for disruption or interruption.
Well, I think, as you said, we're now beyond, in a way, will there ever be a beyond it?
So yes.
There's a very nice parody in Private Eye of, you know, the Prime Minister's, you know, speech to school, whatever, saying 2013, well, it's a great year for looking back at what a great year 2012 was. And that's sort of where it would be interesting to see if we can ever move beyond that, hey, you know, Yeah, we did it.
Yeah, well, in response to the Rio question, actually, I'd started to think, well, yes, you know, when does the event take place? Because actually, in terms of resistance, probably most of that work took place, the most effective work, in the earlier days, yes. And even up until sort of June of 2012, opinion polls were very negative about the games. But then a switch takes place when the event itself.
What about thinking about the Second World War? Because it is almost a kind of, you know, we won. You know, we, the nation, you know, we did it. We beat Hitler. We beat, you know, we won the World Cup. We, you know, it's that kind of, have we ever go, will there ever be an act beyond that? I think is it.
Yeah, and
we are having a little baby, perhaps that would be it.
Yeah. Well, that was the linking up with the 7/7, you know, the bombings that took place in London on 7 July 2005 as well. So I wrote about the kind of mingling of national and urban ideas of community in response to that, and I was interested how in the Olympics 7/7 has become, you know, kept being invoked when Sebastian Coe said in the closing ceremony, this is closure for 7/7, we don't have to think about what happened then anymore, we don't have to think about how it might be wrapped up in you know, British foreign policy and so on, because we've now had a happy event which forms the closure of that rupture, say. Thank you.
Make this quick. I just want to go back to the point about there's a transnational dimension in this specific games can actually be related to the last one in Beijing, because you know, a lot that has like kind of set the standard or the benchmark.
Yes.
England, I don't know whether it was trying to, you know, deliberately trying to supersede, but as it were, there is, you know, there is kind of a transfer of atmosphere in that sense, just like the torch. So, you know, it gets, it infects another space in this sense. And I was also thinking in terms of the architecture, the creation of particular ambiences, whether that travels as well to other places. So just a point about the travelling of atmospheres across the world.
Because an ambience is a personal thing, and you can average what a single person is thinking through an entire crowd or a city or a nation. And it can become something that is more global, feeling good or feeling, you know, happy about something. And usually it works pretty well, but what you need to think also about is that some people are going to be really feeling the opposite at the same time. So the global way of thinking includes also, you know, other people, singular people, maybe unhappy or thinking the opposite or raging, and people are really happy. So when we think about architecture, we always have to balance, you know, the average overall people versus also thinking about, you know, the people are going to experiment difficult aspects of the building. And some, perhaps, those people that are unhappy, because sometimes it's the physical aspects, they experience it differently. You have to be very careful to include that as well. So knowing the diversity of people, the overall assessment will be that this knowledge will enable architects and planners to make sure that, you know, we include also everything.
Thank you for that point. It was very much about Britain having to learn its new place in the world following the Beijing ceremony, you know, coming to terms with the fact that it isn't a global power, and that was very much a theme in the opening ceremony, though the awkward way in which it tries to deal with that, I suppose, you know, what its identity is today then.
Danny?
My question is for both folks, something which is basically the difference between ambience is something that gauges and ambience is something that creates, one in the case of architecture and one in the case of nationalism. So maybe you guys can talk to the difference between gauging versus creation.
The first one is?
Gauging, measuring.
Measuring,
Well, the evaluation,
or
the measuring, as you say, is the way to capture what you can identify or separate from the, you know, overall aspects. You can be happy, but what constitutes that? In terms of architecture, you can decompose that, and when you know those little things that, you know, make people happy or are unhappy about a certain space, provides guidelines and objective, design objectives, and then you can apply them and perhaps, you know, have a better urban area where you have places that can, you know, provide galleries and, you know, art factory experiences like parks and things like that, that you can actually introduce into an overall space. But it's very, we don't see that very much, the inclusion of gathering quantitative or qualitative data and then basing, dealing with that to program design. It usually is done by other experts, and sometimes the architect needs, you know, a way to gather that information in a more direct way of representing it. That's why I presented this work, because I think that it's very difficult for architects to deal with these engineering aspects of the space and those quantitative aspects, which are sometimes very heavy to, you know, it's a burden to start a project when you have a lot of those. And sometimes you don't have the information at all. So that's the biggest problem, when you don't know what to do. So you are basing your principles on what you see, which can be pretty bad because it's your own experience that you're trying to translate into what you're visiting. You're visiting a city, you like it because you come from another, you know, another city, or, you know, or you hate it for different reasons. And it's not something that should, you know, come into the way we design. So I think that the objective way of trying to having a body of knowledge that is more responsive to the way we actually design as architects is a future to gathering engineers and architects to work together with clients. And that's why I think there's a future in, you know, developing those sketchy ways of unifying this knowledge. Yeah.
Any question? Yes, Peter.
It was just whether you'd, you were talking about the almost the kind of labour, or we got into some of the labour politics surrounding volunteering in Olympics. And I wondered if you kind of, it's partly thinking about what were the sort of important sites and spaces that you might touch down on in the project, but one of those that's particularly been interesting to the project that sort of inspired part of this workshop was St Pancras. And I wondered if you picked up on the politics around not volunteering but interning, and the slight differences. And one of the ways that manifested itself in the Olympics at St Pancras was that St Pancras put out a big call for interns to help them marshal people around the station, because it's one of the main arrival points. And a number of different websites that are a kind of a sort of advocacy for interns and why they should, whether they should be paid, picked up on this particular instance, and sort of started to look quite closely at how internships were being advertised at this moment. And they were all about, as you can imagine, the kind of atmospheres of being part of something bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically the St Pancras media director, who we were in touch with to do our work, had to respond to these sorts of comments. His response actually took it in quite a different direction to one that you might expect. It was more kind of, is that of interest? And then there might be some interesting examples of that you could pick.
Yeah, thank you, Pete. There were, of course, different kinds of volunteers, you're right to point that out. There were the Team London volunteers, there were people who took part in the ceremonies, so as acting and singing, as well as people working as games makers, and they would probably lead to a very different experience of the games as well as opportunities for developing forms of being together. I mean, one other thing that's come through with the main volunteers, the games makers, is that they have so much free time, so time hanging around to kind of establish other forms of commonality or belonging, or might call them urban encounters or something that could prove disruptive. But thank you for that. I'll look into it.
Another question? So we stop here?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Budget, yes.
There's one practical announcement I just wanted to make, that's my goal for this week. With the film screening we mentioned earlier, if anyone would like to go to that, it is optional, it's not part of the event, it's just something that's happening. A group of us plan to go to it, leaving from London Euston station. So we'll be outside the station with a kind of concourse with some shops and some restaurants. Things. There's a technology.
Cafe.
So there's a range of places. We'll be there at 6:30 to get the underground down to the venue for the film screening. There is the address in the programme if you want to make your own way, but we'll be heading there if people want someone to follow. And I think you can get food at the venue as well, so if you haven't eaten, there'll be options to get food there as well.
Do you know whether
there's
limited space?
We're getting there a bit early, so I think that was why. Does it start at 7:30, so we'll try and get it for 7 just in case it has been busy in the past week.
It's been, I think, a number of times, it's been really, really busy once.
All right.
So it's difficult to know, but I think